dinner, although I guess I'll probably put on some more miles than you did." Then she laughed, kind of soft, and she gave me a kiss. That was the best kiss I ever had in my whole life, Dave. It was just on the cheek, and it was the chaste kiss of a married woman, but it was as ripe as a peach, or like those flowers that open in the dark. And when her lips touched my skin, I felt like, I don't know exactly what I felt like, because a man can't easily hold on to those things that happened to him with a girl who was ripe when the world was young, or how those things felt. I'm talking around what I mean, but I think you understand. Those things get a red cast to them in your memory, and you cannot see through it at all.
You're a sweet man, Homer, and I love you for listening to me and riding with me, she says. Drive safe.
Then in she went, to that woman's house. Me, I drove home.
How did you go? I asked. He laughed softly.
By the turnpike, you damned fool, he said, and I never seen so many wrinkles in his face before as I did then.
He sat there looking into the sky.
Came the summer. She disappeared. I didn't see much of her. That was the summer we had the fire, you'll remember, and then the big storm that knocked down all the trees, a busy time for caretakers. Oh, I thought about her from time to time, and about that day, and about that kiss, and it started to seem like a dream to me, like one time when I was about 16 and couldn't think about nothing but girls. I was out plowing George Bascom's West Field, the one that looks across the lake at the mountains, dreaming about what teenage boys dream of, and I pulled up this rock with the harrow blades, and it split open, and it bled. At least it looked to me like it bled. Red stuff come running out of the cleft in the rock and soaked into the soil, and I never told no one but my mother. And I never told her what it meant to me or what happened to me, although she washed my drawers, and maybe she knew. Anyway, she suggested I ought to pray on it, which I did, but I never got no enlightenment. And after a while, something started to suggest to my mind that it had been a dream. It's that way, sometimes. There's holes in the middle. Dave, do you know that?
Yes, I says, thinking of one night when I'd seen something. That was in 59, a bad year for us. But my kids didn't know it was a bad year. All they knew was that they wanted to eat, just like always. I'd seen a bunch of whitetail in Henry Brugger's back field, and I was out there after dark with a jacklight in August. You can shoot, too, when there's summer fat. The second will come back and sniff at the first, as if to say, "What the hell, is it fall already?" And you can pop him like a bowling pin. You can hack off enough meat to feed Yowans for 6 weeks and bury what's left. Those are two whitetails the hunters who come in November don't get a shot at, but kids have to eat. Like the man from Massachusetts said, he'd like to be able to afford to live here the year around, and all I can say is sometimes you pay for the privilege after dark. So there I was, and I seen this big orange light in the sky. It come down and down, and I stood and watched it with my mouth hung on down to my breastbone, and when it hit the lake, the whole of it was lit up for a minute, a purple orange that seemed to go right up to the sky and rays. Wasn't nobody ever said nothing to me about that light, and I never said nothing to nobody myself, partly because I was afraid they'd laugh, but also because they'd wonder what the hell I'd been doing out there after dark to start with. And after a while, it was like Homer said. It seemed like a dream I had once had. And it didn't signify to me because I couldn't make nothing of it, which would turn under my hand. It was like a moonbeam. It didn't have no handle, and it didn't have no blade. And I couldn't make it work, so I left it alone, like a man does when he knows the day is going to come up, nevertheless.
There are holes in the middle of things, Homer said.
And he sat up straighter like he was mad.
Right in the damn middle of things. Not even to the left or right, where your peripheral vision is, and you could say, well, but hell, they are there, and you go around them like you'd go around a pothole in the road that would break an axle, you know? And you forget it. Or like if you were plowing, you can plow a dip. But if there's something like a break in the earth, where you see darkness, like a cave might be there, you say, go around, old horse, leave that alone. I got a good shot over here to the leftards. Because it wasn't a cave you was looking for, or some kind of college excitement, but good plowing. Holes. In the middle of things.
He fell still a long time then, and I let him be still. Didn't have no urge to move him. And at last he says,
she disappeared in August. I seen her for the first time in early July, and she looked.
Homer turned to me and spoke each word with careful, spaced emphasis.
Dave Owens, she looked gorgeous. Gorgeous and wild and almost untamed. The little wrinkles I'd started to notice around her eyes all seemed to be gone. Worth Todd, he was at some conference or something in Boston. And she stands there at the edge of the deck. I was out in the middle with my shirt off. And she says,
Homer, you'll never believe it.
No, missus, but I'll try, I says.
I found 2 new roads, she says, and I got up to Bangor this time in just 67 miles.
I remembered what she said before, and I says, that's not possible, missus, begging your pardon, but I did the mileage on the map myself, and 79 is tops, as the crow flies. She laughed, and she looked prettier than ever, like a goddess in the sun, on one of those hills in a story where there's nothing but green grass and fountains and no puckies to tear at a man's forearms at all.
That's right, she says. And you can't run a mile in under 4 minutes. It's been mathematically proved.
It ain't the same, I says.
It's the same, she says. Fold the map and see how many miles it is then, Homer. It can be a little less than a straight line if you fold it a little, or it can be a lot less if you fold it a lot.
I remembered our ride then, the way you remember a dream, and I says, missus, you can fold a map on paper, but you can't fold land, or at least you shouldn't ought to try. You want to leave it alone.
No, sir, she says. It's the one thing right now in my life that I won't leave alone because it's there, and it's mine.
3 weeks later, this would be about 2 weeks before she disappeared, she gave me a call from Bangor. She says,
Worth has gone to New York, and I am coming down. I've misplaced my damn key, Homer. I'd like you to open the house so I can get in.
Well, that call come at 8 o'clock, just when it was starting to come down dark. I had a sandwich and a beer before leaving, about 20 minutes. Then I took a ride down there. All in all, I'd say I was 45 minutes. When I got down there to the Todd's, I seen there was a light on in the pantry I didn't leave on while I was coming down the driveway. I was looking at that, and I almost run right into her little go-devil. It was parked kind of on a slant, the way a drunk would park it, and it was splashed with muck all the way up to the windows, and there was this stuff stuck in that mud along the body that looked like seaweed, only when my lights hit it, it seemed to be moving. I parked behind it and got out of my truck. That stuff wasn't seaweed, but it was weeds, and it was moving, kind of slow and sluggish, like it was dying. I touched a piece of it, and it tried to wrap itself around my hand. It felt nasty and awful. I drug my hand away and wiped it on my pants. I went around to the front of the car. It looked like it had come through about 90 miles of splash and low country. Looked tired, it did. Bugs were splashed all over the windshield, only they didn't look like no kind of bugs I ever seen before. There was a moth that was about the size of a sparrow, its wings still flapping a little, feeble and dying. There was things like mosquitoes, only they had real eyes that you could see, and they seemed to be seeing me. I could hear those weeds scraping against the body of the go-devil, dying, trying to get a hold on something. And all I could think of was, where in hell has she been, and how did she get here in only 3/4 of an hour? Then I seen something else. It was some kind of an animal, half-smashed onto the radiator grill, just under where that Mercedes ornament is, the one that looks kind of like a star, looped up into a circle. Now, most small animals you kill on the road is bore right under the car because they are crouching when it hits them, hoping it'll just go over and leave them with the hide still attached to their meat. But every now and then, one will jump, not away, but right at the damn car, as if to get in one good bite of whatever the buggedly thing is that's going to kill it. I have known that to happen. This thing had maybe done that, and it looked mean enough to jump a Sherman tank. It looked like something which come out of a mating between a woodchuck and a weasel. But there was other stuff thrown in that a body didn't even want to look at. It hurt your eyes, Dave. Worse than that, it hurt your mind. Its pelt was matted with blood, and there was claws sprung out of the pads on its feet like a cat's claws, only longer. It had big, yellowy eyes, only they was glazed. When I was a kid, I had a porcelain marble, a croaker, that looked like that. And teeth, long, thin, needle teeth that looked almost like darning needles sticking out of its mouth. Some of them were sunk right into that steel grillwork. That's why it was still hanging on. It had hung its own self on by the teeth. I looked at it, and I knowed it had a head full of poison, just like a rattlesnake. And it jumped at that go-devil when it saw it was about to be run down, trying to bite it to death. And I wouldn't be the one to try and yank it off of there, because I had cuts on my hands, hay cuts, and I thought it would kill me as dead as a stone parker if some of that poison seeped into the cuts. I went around to the driver's door and opened it. The inside light come on, and I looked at that special odometer that she set for trips. And what I seen there was 31.6. I looked at that for a bit. And then I went to the back door. She'd forced the screen and broke the glass by the lock so she could get a hand through and let herself in. There was a note that said, "Dear Homer, got here a little sooner than I thought I would. Found a shortcut, and it is a dilly. You hadn't come yet, so I let myself in like a burglar. Worth is coming day after tomorrow. Can you get the screen fixed and the door reglazed by then? Hope so. Things like that always bother him. If I don't come out to say hello, you'll know I'm asleep. The drive was very tiring, but I was here in no time. Ophelia." Tiring? I took another look at that bogey thing hanging off of the grill of her car, and I thought, yes, sir, it must have been tiring. By God, yes. He paused again and cracked a restless knuckle. I seen her only once more, about a week later. Worth was there. But he was swimming out in the lake, back and forth, like he was sawing wood or signing papers. More like he was signing papers, I guess. "Missus," I says, "this ain't my business, but you ought to leave well enough alone. That night you come back and broke the glass of the door to come in. I seen something
hanging off the front of your car.
Oh, the chuck, I took care of that, she says.
Christ, I says, I hope you took some care.
I wore Worth's gardening gloves, she said. It wasn't anything anyway, Homer, but a jumped-up woodchuck with a little poison in it.
But, Mrs., I says, where there's woodchucks, there's bears, and if that's what the woodchucks look like along your shortcut, what's going to happen to you if a bear shows up?
She looked at me, and I seen that other woman in her, that Diana woman. She says, if things are different along those roads, Homer, maybe I am different, too. Look at this. Her hair was done up in a clip at the back, looked sort of like a butterfly and had a stick through it. She let it down. It was the kind of hair that would make a man wonder what it would look like spread out over a pillow. She says, it was coming in gray, Homer. Do you see any gray? And she spread it with her fingers so the sun could shine on it. Gnome, I says. She looks at me, her eyes all a sparkle, and she says, your wife is a good woman, Homer Buckland, but she has seen me in the store and in the post office, and we've passed the odd word or two, and I have seen her looking at my hair in a kind of satisfied way that only women know. I know what she says, and what she tells her friends, that Ophelia Todd has started dyeing her hair, but I have not. I have lost my way looking for a shortcut more than once. Lost my way, and lost my gray. And she laughed, not like a college girl, but like a girl in high school. I admired her and longed for her beauty, but I seen that other beauty in her face as well just then, and I felt afraid again, afraid for her, and afraid of her. Missus, I says, you stand to lose more than a little starch in your hair. No, she says, I tell you I am different over there. I am all myself over there. When I am going along that road in my little car, I am not Ophelia Todd, Worth Todd's wife, who could never carry a child to term, or that woman who tried to write poetry and failed at it, or the woman who sits and takes notes in committee meetings, or anything, or anyone else. When I am on that road, I am in the heart of myself, and I feel like...
Diana, I said.
She looked at me, kind of funny and kind of surprised, and then she laughed. Oh, like some goddess, I suppose, she said. She will do better than most, because I am a night person. I love to stay up until my book is done, or until the national anthem comes on the TV, and because I am very pale, like the moon, Worth is always saying I need a tonic, or blood tests, or some sort of similar bosh. But in her heart, what every woman wants to be is some kind of goddess, I think. Men pick up a ruined echo of that thought and try to put them on pedestals. A woman who will pee down her own leg if she does not squat. It's funny when you stop to think of it. But what a man senses is not what a woman wants. A woman wants to be in the clear, is all. To stand, if she will, or walk. Her eyes turned toward that little go-devil in the driveway and narrowed. And then she smiled. Or to drive, Homer. A man will not see that. He thinks a goddess wants to loll on a slope somewhere on the foothills of Olympus and eat fruit. But there is no god or goddess in that. All a woman wants is what a man wants. A woman wants to drive.
Be careful where you drive, missus, is all, I says. And she laughs and give me a kiss, spang in the middle of the forehead.
She says, I will, Homer.
But it didn't mean nothing, and I'd known it, because she said it like a man who says he'll be careful to his wife or his girl when he knows he won't. Can't. I went back to my truck and waved to her once. And it was a week later that Worth reported her missing, her and that go-devil both. Todd waited 7 years, and had her declared legally dead.
And then he waited another year for good measure. I'll give the sucker that much. And then he married the second, Mrs. Todd, the one that just went by. And I don't expect you'll believe a single damn word of the whole yarn.
In the sky, one of those big flat-bottomed clouds moved enough to disclose the ghost of the moon, half full and pale as milk. And something in my heart leaped up at the sight, half in fright, half in love.
"I do, though," I said. "Every friggin' damned word. And even if it ain't true, Homer, it ought to be."
He give me a hug around the neck with his forearm, which is all men can do since the world don't let them kiss, but only women, and laughed and got up.
"Even if it shouldn't ought to be, it is," he said.
He got his watch out of his pants and looked at it.
"I got to go down the road and check on the Scott place. You want to come?"
"I believe I'll sit here for a while," I said, "and think." He went to the steps, then turned back and looked at me, half smiling.
"I believe she was right," he said. "She was different along those roads she found, and wasn't nothing that would dare touch her. You or me, maybe, but not her. And I believe she's young."
Then he got in his truck and set off to check the Scott place. That was 2 years ago. And Homer has since gone to Vermont, as I think I told you. One night he come over to see me. His hair was combed, he had a shave, and he smelled of some nice lotion. His face was clear and his eyes were alive. That night he looked 60 instead of 70. And I was glad for him, and I envied him, and I hated him a little, too. Arthritis is one buggardly great old fisherman. And that night, Homer didn't look like arthritis had any fish hooks sunk into his hands the way they were sunk into mine.
"I'm going," he said.
"Aya?
Aya?"
"All right. Did you see to forward in your mail?"
"Don't want none forwarded," he said. "My bills are paid. I'm going to make a clean break."
"Well, give me your address. I'll drop you a line from one time to another, old hoss." Already I could feel loneliness settling over me like a cloak. And looking at him, I knew that things were not quite what they seemed.
"Don't have none yet," he said.
"All right," I said. "Is it Vermont, Homer?"
"Well," he said, "it'll do for people who want to know."
I almost didn't say it, and then I did. "What does she look like now?"
"Like Diana," he said. "But she is kinder."
"I envy you, Homer," I said, and I did. I stood at the door. It was twilight in that deep part of summer, when the fields fill with perfume and Queen Anne's lace. A full moon was beating a silver track across the lake. He went across my porch and down the steps. A car was standing on the soft shoulder of the road, its engine idling heavy, the way the old ones do that still run full bore straight ahead and down the torpedoes. Now that I think of it, that car looked like a torpedo. It looked beat up some, but as if it could go the ton without breathing hard. He stopped at the foot of my steps and picked something up. It was his gas can, the big one that holds 10 gallons. He went down my walk to the passenger side of the car. She leaned over and opened the door. The inside light came on, and just for a moment I saw her. Long red hair around her face, a forehead shining like a lamp, shining like the moon. He got in and she drove away. I stood out on my porch and watched the taillights of her little go-devil twinkling red in the dark, getting smaller and smaller. They were like embers. Then they were like flicker flies. And then they were gone. Vermont, I tell the folks from town, and Vermont they believe, because it's as far as most of them can see inside their heads. Sometimes I almost believe it myself, mostly when I'm tired and done up. Other times I think about them, though. All this October I have done so, it seems, because October is the time when men think mostly about far places and the roads which might get them there. I sit on the bench in front of Bell's Market and think about Homer Buckland and about the beautiful girl who leaned over to open his door when he came down that path with the full red gasoline can in his right hand. She looked like a girl of no more than 16, a girl on her learner's permit. And her beauty was terrible. But I believe it would no longer kill the man it turned itself on. For a moment her eyes lit on me. I was not killed, although part of me died at her feet. Olympus must be a glory to the eyes and the heart. And there are those who crave it, and those who find a clear way to it, mayhap. But I know Castle Rock, like the back of my hand, and I could never leave it for no shortcuts where the roads may go. In October the sky over the lake is no glory, but it is passing fair with those big white clouds that move so slow. I sit here on the bench and think about Phileas Todd and Homer Buckland. And I don't necessarily wish I was where they are, but I still wish I was a smoking man.
The Jaunt, read by Robert Petkoff.
This is the last call for Jaunt 701,
the pleasant female voice echoed through the blue concourse of New York's Port Authority Terminal. The PAT had not changed much in the last 300 years or so. It was still grungy and a little frightening. The automated female voice was probably the most pleasant thing about it.
This is Jaunt's service to Whitehead City, Mars,
the voice continued.
All ticketed passengers should now be in the Blue Concourse Sleep Lounge. Make sure your validation papers are in order. Thank you.
The upstairs sleep lounge was not at all grungy. It was wall-to-wall carpeted in oyster gray. The walls were in eggshell white and hung with pleasant non-representational prints. A steady, soothing progression of colors met and swirled on the ceiling. There were 100 couches in the large room, neatly spaced in rows of 10. 5 jaunt attendants circulated, speaking in low, cheery voices and offering glasses of milk. At one side of the room was the entranceway, flanked by armed guards and another jaunt attendant, who was checking the validation papers of a latecomer, a harried-looking businessman with the New York World Times folded under one arm. Directly opposite, the floor dropped away in a trough about 5 feet wide and perhaps 10 feet long. It passed through a doorless opening and looked a bit like a child's slide. The Oates family lay side by side on 4 jaunt couches near the far end of the room. Mark Oates and his wife Marilis flanked the 2 children.
"Daddy, will you tell me about the jaunt now?"
Ricky asked.
"You promised."
"Yeah, Dad, you promised,"
Patricia added, and giggled shrilly for no good reason. A businessman with a build like a bull glanced over at them and then went back to the folder of papers he was examining as he lay on his back, his spit-shined shoes neatly together. From everywhere came the low murmur of conversation and the rustle of passengers settling down on the jaunt couches. Mark glanced over at Marilis Oates and winked. She winked back, but she was almost as nervous as Patty sounded. Why not? Mark thought. First jaunt for all three of them. He and Marilys had discussed the advantages and drawbacks of moving the whole family for the last 6 months, since he'd gotten notification from Texaco Water that he was being transferred to Whitehead City. Finally, they had decided that all of them would go for the 2 years Mark would be stationed on Mars. He wondered now, looking at Marilys's pale face, if she was regretting the decision. He glanced at his watch and saw it was still almost half an hour to jaunt time. That was enough time to tell the story, and he supposed it would take the kids' minds off their nervousness. Who knew? Maybe it would even cool Marilys out a little. All right, he said. Ricky and Pat were watching him seriously, his son 12, his daughter 9. He told himself again that Ricky would be deep in the swamp of puberty and his daughter would likely be developing breasts by the time they got back to Earth, and again found it difficult to believe. The kids would be going to the tiny Whitehead combined school with the 100-odd engineering and oil company brats that were there. His son might well be going on a geology field trip to Phobos, not so many months distant. It was difficult to believe, but true. Who knows, he thought wryly. Maybe it'll do something about my jaunt jumps, too. So far as we know, he began, the jaunt was invented about 320 years ago, around the year 1987, by a fellow named Victor Caroon. He did it as part of a private research project that was funded by some government money, and eventually the government took it over, of course. In the end, it came down to either the government or the oil companies. The reason we don't know the exact date is because Caroon was something of an eccentric.
You mean he was crazy, Dad? Ricky asked. Eccentric means a little bit crazy, dear, Marilys said, and smiled across the children at Mark.
She looked a little less nervous now, he thought.
Oh.
Anyway, he'd been experimenting with the process for quite some time before he informed the government of what he had, Mark went on, and he only told them because he was running out of money and they weren't going to refund him.
Your money cheerfully refunded,
Pat said, and giggled shrilly again. That's right, honey, Mark said, and ruffled her hair gently. At the far end of the room, he saw a door slide noiselessly open, and two more attendants came out, dressed in the bright red jumpers of the jaunt service, pushing a rolling table. On it was a stainless steel nozzle attached to a rubber hose. Beneath the table's skirts, tastefully hidden, Mark knew there were two bottles of gas. In the net bag hooked to the side were 100 disposable masks. Mark went on talking, not wanting his people to see the representatives of Leafy until they had to. And if he was given enough time to tell the whole story, they would welcome the gas passers with open arms, considering the alternative. Of course, you know that the jaunt is teleportation, no more or less, he said. Sometimes in college chemistry and physics they call it the Caroon process, but it's really teleportation. And it was Caroon himself, if you can believe the stories, who named it the jaunt. He was a science fiction reader, and there's a story by a man named Alfred Bester, The Stars, My Destination, it's called, and this fellow Bester made up the word jaunt for teleportation in it. Except in his book, you could jaunt just by thinking about it, and we can't really do that. The attendants were fixing a mask to the steel nozzle and handing it to an elderly woman at the far end of the room. She took it, inhaled once, and fell quiet and limp on her couch. Her skirt had pulled up a little, revealing one slack thigh road-mapped with varicose veins. An attendant considerately readjusted it for her while the other pulled off the used mask and affixed a fresh one. It was a process that made Mark think of the plastic glasses in motel rooms. He wished to God that Patty would cool out a little bit. He had seen children who had to be held down, and sometimes they screamed as the rubber mask covered their faces. It was not an abnormal reaction in a child, he supposed, but it was nasty to watch, and he didn't want to see it happen to Patty. About Rick, he felt more confident.
I guess you could say the jaunt came along at the last possible moment, he resumed. He spoke toward Ricky, but reached across and took his daughter's hand. Her fingers closed over his with an immediate panicky tightness. Her palm was cool and sweating lightly. The world was running out of oil, and most of what was left belonged to the Middle Eastern desert peoples, who were committed to using it as a political weapon. They had formed an oil cartel they called OPEC.
What's a cartel, Daddy?
Patty asked.
Well, a monopoly, Mark said.
Like a club, honey,
Marilla said, and you could only be in that club if you had lots of oil.
Oh.
I don't have time to sketch the whole mess in for you, Mark said. You'll study some of it in school, but it was a mess. Let's let it go at that. If you owned a car, you could only drive it 2 days a week, and gasoline cost 15 old bucks a gallon.
Gosh, Ricky said. It only costs 4 cents or so a gallon now, doesn't it, Dad?
Mark smiled. That's why we're going where we're going, Rick. There's enough oil on Mars to last almost 8,000 years, and enough on Venus to last another 20,000. But oil isn't even that important anymore. Now what we need most of all is...
Water!
Patty cried, and the businessman looked up from his papers and smiled at her for a moment. That's right, Mark said, because in the years between 1960 and 2030, we poisoned most of ours. The first water lift from the Martian ice caps was called
Operation Straw.
That was Ricky. Yes, 2045 or thereabouts, but long before that, the jaunt was being used to find sources of clean water here on Earth. And now, water is our major Martian export. The oil's strictly a sideline, but it was important then. The kids nodded. The point is, those things were always there, but we were only able to get it because of the jaunt. When Karun invented his process, the world was slipping into a new dark age. The winter before, over 10,000 people had frozen to death in the United States alone because there wasn't enough energy to heat them.
Oh, yuck,
Patty said matter-of-factly. Mark glanced to his right and saw the attendants talking to a timid-looking man, persuading him. At last, he took the mask and seemed to fall dead on his couch seconds later.
First-timer, Mark thought. You can always tell.
For Karun, it started with a pencil, some keys, a wristwatch, then some mice. The mice showed him there was a problem. Victor Karun came back to his laboratory in a stumbling fever of excitement. He thought he knew now how Morse had felt, and Alexander Graham Bell, and Edison. But this was bigger than all of them, and twice he had almost wrecked the truck on the way back from the pet shop in New Paltz, where he had spent his last $20 on 9 white mice. What he had left in the world was the 93 cents in his right front pocket and the $18 in his savings account. But this did not occur to him. And if it had, it certainly would not have bothered him. The lab was in a renovated barn at the end of a mile-long dirt road off Route 26. It was making the turn onto this road where he had just missed cracking up his brat pickup truck for the second time. The gas tank was almost empty, and there would be no more for 10 days to 2 weeks, but this did not concern him either. His mind was in a delirious whirl. What had happened was not totally unexpected, no. One of the reasons the government had funded him, even to the paltry tune of $20,000 a year, was because the unrealized possibility had always been there in the field of particle transmission. But to have it happen like this, suddenly, with no warning, and powered by less electricity than was needed to run a color TV. God! Christ! He brought the brat to a screech halt in the dirt of the dooryard, grabbed the box on the dirty seat beside him by its grab handles. On the box were dogs and cats and hamsters and goldfish and the legend, I came from Stackpole's House of Pets, and ran for the big double doors. From inside the box came the scurry and whisk of his test subjects. He tried to push one of the big doors open along its track, and when it wouldn't budge, he remembered that he had locked it. Karun uttered a loud, shit, and fumbled for his keys. The government commanded that the lab be locked at all times. It was one of the strings they put on their money, but Karun kept forgetting. He brought his keys out and for a moment simply stared at them, mesmerized, running the ball of his thumb over the notches in the brat's ignition key. He thought again, God! Christ! Then he scrabbled through the keys on the ring for the Yale key that unlocked the barn door. As the first telephone had been used inadvertently, Bell crying into it, Watson, come here, when he spilled some acid on his papers and himself, so the first act of teleportation had occurred by accident. Victor Karun had teleported the first 2 fingers of his left hand across the 50-yard width of the barn. Karun had set up two portals at opposite sides of the barn. On his end was a simple ion gun, available from any electronics supply warehouse for under $500. On the other end, standing just beyond the far portal, both of them rectangular and the size of a paperback book, was a cloud chamber. Between them was what appeared to be an opaque shower curtain, except that shower curtains are not made of lead. The idea was to shoot the ions through portal one and then walk around and watch them streaming across the cloud chamber standing just beyond portal two, with the lead shield between to prove they really were being transmitted. Except that for the last 2 years, the process had only worked twice, and Karun didn't have the slightest idea why. As he was setting the ion gun in place, his fingers had slipped through the portal. Ordinarily no problem, but this morning, his hip had also brushed the toggle switch on the control panel at the left of the portal. He was not aware of what had happened, the machinery gave off only the lowest audible hum, until he felt a tingling sensation in his fingers. It was not like an electric shock, Karun wrote in his one and only article on the subject before the government shut him up. The article was published, of all places, in Popular Mechanics. He had sold it to them for $750 in a last-ditch effort to keep the jaunt a matter of private enterprise. There was none of that unpleasant tingle that one gets if one grasps a frayed lamp cord, for instance. It was more like the sensation one gets if one puts one's hand on the casing of some small machine that is working very hard. The vibration is so fast and light that it is, literally, a tingling sensation. Then I looked down at the portal and saw that my index finger was gone on a diagonal slant through the middle knuckle, and my second finger was gone slightly above that. In addition, the nail portion of my third finger had disappeared. Karun had jerked his hand back instinctively, crying out. He so much expected to see blood, he wrote later, that he actually hallucinated blood for a moment or two. His elbow struck the ion gun and knocked it off the table. He stood there with his fingers in his mouth, verifying that they were still there, and whole. The thought that he had been working too hard crossed his mind. And then the other thought crossed his mind. The thought that the last set of modifications might have done something. He did not push his fingers back in. In fact, Karun only jaunted once more in his entire life. At first, he did nothing. He took a long, aimless walk around the barn, running his hands through his hair, wondering if he should call Carson in New Jersey or perhaps Buffington in Charlotte. Carson wouldn't accept a collect phone call, the cheap, ass-kissing bastard, but Buffington probably would. Then an idea struck, and he ran across to Portal 2, thinking that if his fingers had actually crossed the barn, there might be some sign of it. There was not, of course. Portal 2 stood atop three stacked Pomona orange crates, looking like nothing so much as one of those toy guillotines missing the blade. On one side of its stainless steel frame was a plug-in jack, from which a cord ran back to the transmission terminal, which was little more than a particle transformer hooked into a computer feed line. Which reminded him. Karun glanced at his watch and saw it was 11:15. His deal with the government consisted of short money plus computer time, which was infinitely valuable. His computer tie-in lasted until 3:00 this afternoon, and then it was goodbye until Monday. He had to get moving. Had to do something. I glanced at the pile of crates again, Karun writes in his Popular Mechanics article, and then I looked at the pads of my fingers, and sure enough, the proof was there. It would not, I thought then, convince anyone but myself, but in the beginning, of course, it is only oneself that one has to convince.
What was it, Dad? Ricky asked.
Yeah,
Patty added. What?
Mark grinned a little. They were all hooked now, even Marilis. They had nearly forgotten where they were. From the corner of his eye, he could see the jaunt attendants whisper wheeling their cart slowly among the jaunters, putting them to sleep. It was never as rapid a process in the civilian sector as it was in the military, he had discovered. Civilians got nervous and wanted to talk it over. The nozzle and the rubber mask were too reminiscent of hospital operating rooms, where the surgeon with his knives lurked somewhere behind the anesthetist with her selection of gases in stainless steel canisters. Sometimes there was panic.
hysteria. And always there were a few who simply lost their nerve. Mark had observed two of these as he spoke to the children. Two men who had simply arisen from their couches, walked across to the entryway with no fanfare at all, unpinned the validation papers that had been affixed to their lapels, turned them in, and exited without looking back. Jaunt attendants were under strict instructions not to argue with those who left. There were always standbys, sometimes as many as 40 or 50 of them hoping against hope. As those who simply couldn't take it left, standbys were let in with their own validations pinned to their shirts. Karun found two splinters in his index finger, he told the children. He took them out and put them aside. One was lost, but you can see the other one in the Smithsonian Annex in Washington. It's in a hermetically sealed glass case near the moon rocks the first space travelers brought back from the moon.
Our moon, Dad, or one of Mars's? Ricky asked.
Ours, Mark said, smiling a little. Only one manned rocket flight has ever landed on Mars, Ricky, and that was a French expedition somewhere about 2030. Anyway, that's why there happens to be a plain old splinter from an orange crate in the Smithsonian Institution, because it's the first object that we have that was actually teleported, jaunted, across space.
What happened then? Patty asked.
Well, according to the story, Karun ran. Karun ran back to Portal One and stood there for a moment, heart thudding, out of breath. Gotta calm down, he told himself. Got to think about this. You can't maximize your time if you go off half-cocked. Deliberately disregarding the forefront of his mind, which was screaming at him to hurry up and do something, he dug his nail clippers out of his pocket and used the point of the file to dig the splinters out of his index finger. He dropped them onto the white inner sleeve of a Hershey bar he had eaten while tinkering with the transformer and trying to widen its afferent capability. He had apparently succeeded in that beyond his wildest dreams. One rolled off the wrapper and was lost. The other ended up in the Smithsonian Institution, locked in a glass case that was cordoned off with thick velvet ropes and watched vigilantly and eternally by a computer-monitored closed-circuit TV camera. The splinter extraction finished, Karun felt a little calmer. A pencil. That was as good as anything. He took one from beside the clipboard on the shelf above him and ran it gently into Portal One. It disappeared smoothly, inch by inch, like something in an optical illusion or in a very good magician's trick. The pencil had said Eberhard Faber Number 2 on one of its sides, black letters stamped on yellow-painted wood. When he had pushed the pencil in until all but E-B-E-R-H had disappeared, Karun walked around to the other side of Portal One. He looked in. He saw the pencil in cut-off view, as if a knife had chopped smoothly through it. Karun felt with his fingers where the rest of the pencil should have been, and of course, there was nothing. He ran across the barn to Portal Two, and there was the missing part of the pencil, lying on the top crate. Heart thumping so hard that it seemed to shake his entire chest, Karun grasped the sharpened point of his pencil and pulled it the rest of the way through. He held it up. He looked at it. Suddenly, he took it and wrote, "It works," on a piece of barn board. He wrote it so hard that the lead snapped on the last letter. Karun began to laugh shrilly in the empty barn, to laugh so hard that he startled the sleeping swallows into flight among the high rafters.
"Works!"
he shouted, and ran back to Portal One. He was waving his arms, the broken pencil knotted up in one fist.
"Works! Works! Do you hear me, Carson, you prick? It works! And I did it!"
"Mark, watch what you say to the children," Marilis reproached him.
Mark shrugged. "It's what he's supposed to have said."
"Well, can't you do a little selective editing?"
"Dad?"
Patty asked.
"Is that pencil in the museum, too?"
"Does a bear shit in the woods?" Mark said, and then clapped one hand over his mouth. Both children giggled wildly, but that shrill note was gone from Patty's voice, Mark was glad to hear. And after a moment of trying to look serious, Marilis began to giggle, too. The keys went through next.
Karun simply tossed them through the portal. He was beginning to think on track again now, and it seemed to him that the first thing that needed finding out was if the process produced things on the other end exactly as they had been, or if they were in any way changed by the trip. He saw the keys go through and disappear. At exactly the same moment, he heard them jingle on the crate across the barn. He ran across, really only trotting now, and on the way, he paused to shove the lead shower curtain back on its track. He didn't need either it or the ion gun now. Just as well, since the ion gun was smashed beyond repair. He grabbed the keys, went to the lock the government had forced him to put on the door, and tried the Yale key. It worked perfectly. He tried the house key. It also worked. So did the keys which opened his file cabinets and the one which started the brat pickup. Karun pocketed the keys and took off his watch. It was a Seiko Quartz LC with a built-in calculator below the digital face. 24 tiny buttons that would allow him to do everything from addition to subtraction to square roots. A delicate piece of machinery, and, just as important, a chronometer. Karun put it down in front of Portal 1 and pushed it through with a pencil. He ran across and grabbed it up. When he put it through, the watch had said 11:31:07. It now said 11:31:49. Very good. Right on the money. Only he should have had an assistant over there to peg the fact that there had been no time gain once and forever. Well, no matter. Soon enough, the government would have him wading hip-deep in assistance. He tried the calculator. 2 and 2 still made 4. 8 divided by 4 was still 2. The square root of 11 was still 3.3166247, and so on. That was when he decided it was mouse time.
"What happened with the mice, Dad?" Ricky asked. Mark hesitated briefly.
There would have to be some caution here if he didn't want to scare his children, not to mention his wife, into hysteria minutes away from their first jaunt. The major thing was to leave them with the knowledge that everything was all right now, that the problem had been licked.
As I said, there was a slight problem.
Yes, horror, lunacy, and death. How's that for a slight problem, kids?
Karun set the box, which read, "I came from Stackpole's House of Pets," down on the shelf and glanced at his watch. Damned if he hadn't put the thing on upside down. He turned it around and saw that it was 2:15. He had only an hour and a quarter of computer time left. How the time flies when you're having fun, he thought, and giggled wildly. He opened the box, reached in, and pulled out a squeaking white mouse by the tail. He put it down in front of Portal 1 and said, "Go on, mouse." The mouse promptly ran down the side of the orange crate on which the portal stood and scuttered across the floor. Cursing, Karun chased it and managed to actually get one hand on it before it squirmed through a crack between 2 boards and was gone.
"Shit!"
Karun screamed and ran back to the box of mice. He was just in time to knock 2 potential escapees back into the box. He got a second mouse, holding this one around the body. He was by trade a physicist, and the ways of white mice were foreign to him, and slammed the lid of the box back down. This one he gave the old heave-ho. It clutched at Karun's palm, but to no avail. It went head over ratty little paws through Portal 1. Karun heard it immediately land on the crates across the barn. This time he sprinted, remembering how easily the first mouse had eluded him. He need not have worried. The white mouse merely crouched on the crate, its eyes dull, its sides aspirating weakly. Karun slowed down and approached it carefully. He was not a man used to fooling with mice, but you didn't have to be a 40-year veteran to see something was terribly wrong here. The mouse didn't feel so good after it went through, Mark Oates told his children with a wide smile that was only noticeably false to his wife. Karun touched the mouse. It was like touching something inert, packed straw or sawdust, perhaps, except for the aspirating sides. The mouse did not look around at Karun. It stared straight ahead. He had thrown in a squirming, very frisky and alive little animal. Here was something that seemed to be a living waxwork likeness of a mouse. Then Karun snapped his fingers in front of the mouse's small pink eyes. It blinked and fell dead on its side.
So Karun decided to try another mouse, Mark said.
What happened to the first mouse? Ricky asked.
Mark produced that wide smile again. It was retired with full honors, he said. Karun found a paper bag and put the mouse into it. He would take it to Moscone, the vet, that evening. Moscone could dissect it and tell him if its inner works had been rearranged. The government would disapprove his bringing a private citizen into a project which would be classified triple top secret as soon as they knew about it. Tough titty, as the kitty was reputed to have said to the babes who complained about the warmth of the milk. Karun was determined that the great white father in Washington would know about this as late in the game as possible. For all the scant help the great white father had given him, he could wait. Tough titty. Then he remembered that Moscone lived way the hell and gone on the other side of New Paltz, and that there wasn't enough gas in the brat to get even halfway across town, let alone back. But it was 2:03. He had less than an hour of computer time left. He would worry about the goddamn dissection later. Karun constructed a makeshift chute leading to the entrance of Portal 1. Really, the first jaunt slide, Mark told the children, and Patty found the idea of a jaunt slide for mice deliciously funny, and dropped a fresh white mouse into it. He blocked the end with a large book, and after a few moments of aimless pattering and sniffing, the mouse went through the portal and disappeared. Karun ran back across the barn. The mouse was DOA. There was no blood, no bodily swellings to indicate that a radical change in pressure had ruptured something inside. Karun supposed that oxygen starvation might... He shook his head impatiently. It took the white mouse only nanoseconds to go through. His own watch had confirmed that time remained a constant in the process, or damn close to it. The second white mouse joined the first in the paper sack. Karun got a third out, a fourth if you counted the fortunate mouse that had escaped through the crack, wondering for the first time which would end first, his computer time or his supply of mice. He held this one firmly around the body and forced its haunches through the portal. Across the room, he saw the haunches reappear, just the haunches. The disembodied little feet were digging frantically at the rough wood of the crate. Karun pulled the mouse back. No catatonia here. It bit the webbing between his thumb and forefinger hard enough to bring blood. Karun dropped the mouse hurriedly back into the I Came From Stackpole's House of Pets box and used the small bottle of hydrogen peroxide in his lab first aid kit to disinfect the bite. He put a band-aid over it, then rummaged around until he found a pair of heavy work gloves. He could feel the time running out, running out, running out. It was 2:11 now. He got another mouse out and pushed it through backward, all the way. He hurried across to Portal 2. This mouse lived for almost 2 minutes. It even walked a little, after a fashion. It staggered across the Pomona orange crate, fell on its side, struggled weakly to its feet, and then only squatted there. Karun snapped his fingers near its head, and it lurched perhaps 4 steps further before falling on its side again. The aspiration of its side slowed. Slowed. Stopped. It was dead. Karun felt a chill. He went back, got another mouse, and pushed it halfway through head first. He saw it reappear at the other end, just the head, then the neck and chest. Cautiously, Karun relaxed his grip on the mouse's body, ready to grab it if it got frisky. It didn't. The mouse only stood there, half of it on one side of the barn, half on the other. Karun jogged back to Portal 2. The mouse was alive, but its pink eyes were glazed and dull. Its whiskers didn't move. Going around to the back of the portal, Karun saw an amazing sight. As he had seen the pencil in cutaway, so now he saw the mouse.
He saw the vertebrae of its tiny spine ending abruptly in round white circles. He saw its blood moving through the vessels.